So there you are. Welcome to this special edition of the Richard Rudin podcast for this Christmas 2024. Of course, I've no idea, due to the nature of podcasts unlike radio, whenever you're going to hear this. So I hope you are having, did have, or about to have a wonderful Christmas and New Year. Well, this special edition is an archive recording of an interview I did with Sir Peter Ustinov in Sheffield when I was working for the BBC local radio station there towards the end of 1991. It was a time of much tumult in the world. The Soviet Union had just collapsed and the Dubrovnik was being shelled during the wars there, which I won't bother to try and explain now because, gosh, does anybody write about that period? I mean, it's an extraordinary period. But these are the circumstances in which we met, which is important to state because of Peter Ustinov's reputation and achievements as a goodwill ambassador and humanitarian. Well, let's just start with some facts, and this is from Wikipedia, which I feel okay in quoting because, apart from the fact it's an open source resource for the internet, I think the most wonderful part of the internet ever, but I also do contribute to it occasionally. So, Sir Peter Alexander Ustinov, born Peter Alexander Freiherr von Ustinov, 16th of April 1921 to 28th of March 2004, was a British actor, director and writer. An internationally known raconteur, he was a fixture on television talk shows and lecture circuits for much of his career. Ustinov received numerous accolades, including 2 Academy Awards, a BAFTA Award, 3 Emmy Awards and a Grammy Award. He also displayed a unique cultural versatility, which frequently earned him the accolade of a Renaissance man. An intellectual and diplomat, he held various academic posts and served as a goodwill ambassador for UNICEF and president of the World Federalist Movement. In 2003, Durham University changed the name of its graduate society to Ustinov College in honour of the significant contributions Ustinov had made as Chancellor of the University from 1992 until his death. When his father was of Russian, German, Polish, Ethiopian and Jewish descent, his paternal grandfather was a Russian noble and his grandmother was a mixture of German, Ethiopian and Jewish origin. Ustinov's great-grandfather, a Jewish refugee from Krakow and later a Christian convert and colleague of Swiss and German missionaries in Ethiopia, married into a German-Ethiopian family. Ustinov's paternal great-great-grandparents were the German painter Eduard Zander and the Ethiopian aristocrat court Lady Izet Veg of Gondar. His mother, known as Nadia, was a painter and ballet dancer of French, German, Italian and Russian descent. Her father was an Imperial Russian architect and owner of Leonardo da Vinci's painting Benoit Madonna. Leon's brother was a stage designer who worked with Stravinsky. Their paternal ancestor was a chef who had left France for St. Petersburg during the French Revolution and became a chef to Emperor Paul I of Russia. Well, it's such an exotic background, surely unique, and that makes him a unique guest of all the people I've interviewed, famous and not famous, throughout my career. Ustinov has to be at the top there, in terms of his background, his experience on the chat show circuit, which was a bit unnerving, being as he'd been interviewed by the best in the business several times. In fact, he appeared on the Parkinson show more than anybody else. And there was also Johnny Carson, regular on The Tonight Show in America, and all the way around the globe. Well, his fluency in so many languages made him ideal for international work, and his general humanitarian beliefs shine through his work. And I'll just read you a little bit before I get into the interview itself and my introduction to this. From his autobiography published in 1977, which I thoroughly recommend, called Dear Me. And it starts naturally by going into his birth, and I'll just read you a bit of that. He says, "Of the actual events surrounding my birth, I remember very little and must therefore base my report on data from other sources. What I do know for certain is that where I was born in London, in a section ominously called Swiss Cottage, I was in fact conceived in Leningrad, in a tall, drafty and shell-pocked house to which I made a pilgrimage of thanksgiving relatively late in life. It stands to reason that I travelled a great deal during the more than 9 months which separated my conception in the shadow of revolution and political slogan to my birth in the cold embrace of industrial smog and respectability. But once again, my memory of the great social upheavals through which I passed, disguised as a piece of overweight luggage, can only be described as hazy and therefore unreliable. It might be well to pause at this early juncture to try and make some order out of the arbitrary events which led to my appointment with the gynaecologist in Swiss Cottage at 11 o'clock on April the 16th, 1921. I was, of course, accompanied by my mother, since I was too young to go alone. There's one bit I love. Talking about the unlikely event of his parents ever meeting. It needed the precipitate action of a Serbian student in Sarajevo, the sabre-rattling of the Austro-Hungarian war party, the limitless ambitions of the Kaiser, the French desire for revenge, the immense speed of the Russian mobilisation, the war at sea, in the air, on land, gas, revolution, humiliation and conquest to bring them together. I can never hope to repay the immense war debt which I personally owe to millions of people whose concerted egotism, self-sacrifice, stupidity, wisdom, bravery, cowardice, honour and dishonour made it possible for my parents to meet under the least likely of circumstances and with the most far-fetched of pretexts. There is no alternative but humility for me. Well, that gives you a measure of the man and his brilliance as a writer, amongst other things, as well as being an actor and director of stage, of screen, of opera, of Agatha Christie. Just the range of his work is quite extraordinary, and the life he has led is even more extraordinary. Being old enough to have met and worked with some of the Hollywood greats to more recent triumphs in The Muppet Show, for example. So Peter Ustinov is the name. This interview is the game, and this is from a special I did for Christmas 1991 on BBC Radio Sheffield. He was appearing in the city as part of a tour to promote a new collection of writings of his. And Sheffield, in fact, was one of the few locations in the country which had been treated to this one-man show. And I began by asking him why he had chosen to do the Lyceum Theatre in Sheffield above all the other possible venues and cities that he could have played at.
I heard the theatre had been refurbished and was magnificent, and of course I'm always tempted by magnificent venues, as they say, and I know, of course, Mr. Barry from Bath, and that was an additional incentive.
He's the chief executive of Sheffield Theatres,
yes.
For anyone who doesn't know.
Yes. And so I came. I've done Bradford before, which is not terribly far away. So I've done several British cities since, and Irish ones. I was in Dublin last week and in Belfast the week before that.
In your book, latest book, Ustinov at Large, you talk about, I think it was a maid from Halifax in Yorkshire, and you talk about the warm Yorkshire voice. Is there something about accents that make them sound warm or cold, do you think?
Oh, I think so. I think definitely it's a reflection of the personalities of people who live in that place. Why the tongue and the palate moves in such a way as to make it a way of speaking, I have no idea, but certainly there's something very comfortable about that way of talking. Jack Priestley, who was really a rather sharp man, seemed not to be because of his accent.
Let's talk about putting together a show, a one-man show, for a moment. Clearly, people in an audience want to hear gossip and anecdotes, really, about the famous. And it can almost sound, I suppose, as if you're name-dropping on some occasions for the sake of it, if you're not careful. What would you leave out? Because you've met so many celebrities, obviously, and you must have encountered them in rather embarrassing situations sometimes. I mean, would you put anything in, or would you leave out for the sake of embarrassment some tales which you could have included?
Oh, I think I would leave out for the sake of embarrassment. Yeah, not really embarrassment, but if I deem it unfair to the people, then I try and leave it out, because I've been a victim of that kind of saving your presence journalism all my life, and so I know what is tactful. You can say almost anything if you do it in a manner which is civilized and you and they feel that you've entertained different thoughts on the way to your conclusion. But if it's just a snap decision, I mean, I know of one case where I was subjected to a critic who gave me really a vile notice. And when asked why, he said, well, he's going to have full houses anyway. You know, that's not an excuse, really. So I tend to be rather tactful towards those whom I've caught with their pants down or who said things which they might regret. I would never try and explain. That's not my business. I'm not in the gossip column business.
No, indeed. But as you say, it's the way you tell them, really, isn't it, in many cases, that you could actually, I suggest, get away with saying something which might be offensive from somebody else.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. And it could be that I really dislike a thing sufficiently to be incredibly tactful about it. But anybody with any sensibility would be able to read between the lines. That's another technique, of course.
Well, let's just remind ourselves of a little bit of gossip that you committed to vinyl back in the early 1960s in the conversation with, amongst others, the late Kenneth Alsop, when you were talking about your close friend Humphrey Bogart, who apparently you were trying to claim was in hospital, and you carried out this practical joke on an increasingly anxious director of the African Queen, John Huston.
He said, hello, is Mr. Bogart there? He's been phoning me. I said, who? Mr. Humphrey Bogart? I don't know, you know, I'm not the regular man here, of course. I've only just come on, as a matter of fact, and I've been ill myself. Well, this is Mr. Huston here. Who did you want to speak to? One of the officials of the hospital here. No, I have a call from Mr. Bogart. Oh, I don't know. You're Mr. Bogart, are you? No, I'm Mr. Huston, and so it went on. Well, I don't know. You see, I don't like to touch any of these instruments here because I don't know where anything leads to. I don't want to be inhospitable or anything. If somebody's been calling you, wouldn't it be better to wait till they call back again? Well, I don't know what's wrong with him. Why did he call? Well, I don't know. Eventually, I let myself be persuaded by him to call up the various departments, and I went, hello? Is that the casualty ward? No, this is maternity here. I'm sorry. And I went right round the imaginary hospital like that doing this. And eventually got to, well, I said, yes. Is that casualty ward?
Yes.
Is it got a man called Mr. Huston? No, no, I'm sorry, Mr. Boger.
Oh, yes. Who wants to speak to him?
It's me, John Huston. I'm directing the picture.
You want to speak to him, yes. You
are what concerned with the picture? I'm the director.
Oh, you're not the producer?
No, I'm the director.
I've always wanted to know what the difference is between those two. Is there a great difference? And so on, we went from it.
But I wouldn't say what was wrong with Bogart, and eventually I said, well, I would rather wait until there's a second and even third opinion, and they won't be here for another, oh, it's now 20 past, when he's always late. About 3/4 of an hour, I think, could be over. You've got to tell me, and I said, well, I suspect, and I'll tell you this off the record, it's a fractured eyelash, and fractured in two places, in fact. And then there was a long pause, and he realised... It's just my revenge.
Let's talk a bit about the business of directing. I wonder how much charm you sometimes have to switch on when dealing with some of the prima donnas, which legend has it populate the operatic world, the opera world, for example.
Well, you have to be a bit of a psychiatrist, of course, in that case, because operatic is slightly different because there's a barrier of music between you and them, which gallops to the rescue, however badly things are going, like the US cavalry, in the last minute when you're being overwhelmed by all this. Suddenly Mozart gallops to the rescue, and God bless him. But with a play or something like that, there are really so many different kinds of... there are as many different kinds of actors as there are people. And some of them like discussing a great deal. I personally hate it. I prefer practical things because then you can put them right. You can discuss something that's there, but not something that's not yet there. And they're very exhausting people, those. There are some who like kindness. There are some who like a low temperature. There are some who can only work in a kind of frenzy of intellectual ferment. And there are some who are vaguely masochistic, who enjoy being tortured in public, and some of them who hate it. So you have to be very careful what you do. You can't just treat them as a mass. You have to treat them as individuals the whole time and cater to whatever needs you feel they need. And in that sense, you really have to be a psychologist at least, if not a psychiatrist.
Do you think you're better at giving direction than taking it, or equal at both?
No, I'm pretty good at ignoring it. if I get directions which I think are really wrong, I try and get away with what I think, rather like a smuggler, contraband going through customs. I'm not always hard enough when giving directions, simply because I believe that an artist has the right to make his own discoveries, and that I think also that rehearsals are really the beginning of a mutual adventure. It's not a dictatorship. You can't dictate to them, you're not in their shoes. And I realized that also, I've always thought it, but when I played King Lear in Stratford in Ontario twice, you start by reading with enormous respect all the observations by the professors on what the lines mean and so on. And then as you begin rehearsing it, you begin to forget these instructions from the professors. And eventually, after 4 or 5 weeks rehearsal, you're in a coracle with Shakespeare himself floating out to sea, and the professors are as static and as earthbound as the bungalows on the seashore, and you gradually lose sight of them. And if you read them again once you're performing the play, they're quite risible at times. And then, before you get too hostile towards them, you realize that some of them are just about as wise as they can be by only reading the plays and not actually having to perform them, which is quite a different problem. And I remember one instruction at the bottom of our acting edition of King Lear, which said, gave the opinion of one pundit, and then it added, "Kirschbaum, however, disagrees with this." And that became the symbol of our whole production. Every time anything went vaguely wrong, I said, "Kirschbaum."
Well, here you are, directing a little bit, once again, a rather old recording, this, I'm afraid, a little bit of mock Mozart. Let's switch tack and talk about the other areas of your interest, which are in the international field of human suffering in many ways. And I'd like, firstly, because it is so topical, to talk about Yugoslavia, because one of your many honours is indeed from Yugoslavia. This morning, I mean, as we're talking, Dubrovnik is being pounded, and there is talk of both the Serbs and the Croats demanding a peacekeeping force. How would you see the way out of the impasse, or is there one at the moment?
Well, I wrote my article this week in the European. I've just been reading The Independent up at breakfast, but in the European, about roughly that subject, that there is a case of two peoples who are divided by the same language. The language is called Serbo-Croat. They haven't yet tried to split that. In fact, I don't know how they would at this stage, but it's inevitably called that. But one has a long tradition of rather surly independence in the Balkans. It inherited the Cyrillic alphabet, which seems to make all the difference, and the Orthodox Church. The others were for a long time part of the Austro-Hungarian Empire, therefore subject to intense Catholic influence, and also write in the Roman alphabet. Well, these things seem to separate them. And I think that prejudice comes at school. I call it the sediment at the bottom of a bottle of education. They've inherited these things, and they remember, for some reason, the last war, And they're very hostile towards each other, accusing each other of being fascists and communists, as though the whole Chetnik Tito business had never been forgotten. And I think it's extremely painful, of course. In this late stage, Europe cannot afford this kind of nonsense, retrospective nonsense, especially at a place so close to where the First World War broke out. We mustn't forget it all started there. At least that was the pretext. It was ready to start anywhere. But it's one of those cases where perhaps people have to be conscious of their independence before they can risk what we're all being asked to risk now, I personally with joy, which is interdependence. Once you're sure of your independence, you welcome interdependence, because after all, it's a fraternal thing and it's a very constructive thing. It'll be better financially and morally, I think, for all of us if that fact is recognized. And it's tragic that these people aren't up to that level yet and still think, when you see these serried ranks of Serbian generals, you really shudder, because it's nothing to do with our epoch. It's something before the fax, the telegram. It's absolutely archaic and so stupid. I hoped at the beginning, when they were still having mothers going to fetch their sons from barracks, I thought it was going to be rather like Lysistrata in Greek history, in which the women refused their services to the men until they stopped making war. And after all, these elderly women reclaiming their sons from barracks, the generals usually gave in, because I don't know of any general who hasn't had a mother at some time or other and been subject to that kind of pressure. Unfortunately, it took a completely arbitrary form and a pretty stupid form, quite frankly. And the fact that human lives are being lost daily is just as grave as anything that happens to the architecture of Dubrovnik. Dubrovnik, where I saw a play in rehearsal a long time ago, and tiptoed there, and they beckoned me to keep quiet and to sit down if I want to watch. And it was a play, I thought it was Shylock, because there was a Jewish usurer. There were people who looked exactly like the characters of Merchant of Venice. But there was also a slightly queer German count who I don't think appears in Shakespeare, and a courtesan or two. It was an extremely funny play, at which at one moment the Shylock equivalent looked at the audience in an aside and said, "I've got half an hour to spare. The negotiation went rather quicker than I had thought. What shall I do with my time? Ah, I know. As an Orthodox Jew, I'll go home for half an hour and wait for the Messiah." And it was very skittish, the whole thing. I then asked what it was. It was written by a Dalmatian author from Dubrovnik called Držić, if you can pronounce that. It was written in 1515, long before The Merchant of Venice, which not only shows that all these stories were current at the time and Shakespeare just took his pick, but it also shows that the culture of the Dalmatian coast is frightfully old, impregnated with Venetian influence, but still, one should be reverent enough not to be stupid and bombarded like this. And it's got nothing to do with Serbia in any case. I got a telephone call from a Serb the other day asking me to send a telegram to Mr. Tudjman, the president of Croatia, asking him to evacuate Dubrovnik so that it wouldn't be shelled any further. I said, "Not at all. You send a telegram to your generals to ask them to stop shelling it. That's the only way to stop it."
In your book, Ustinov at Large, you say that if there were more than 200 flags at the United Nations, that it would be a tragedy. And yet, elsewhere, particularly, of course, in the Soviet Union, we're now seeing what were the republics demanding nationhood. What is so wrong about that? Why shouldn't Estonia be recognised, for example, your own family background, as a separate country and have its own flag and its own representatives in the United Nations?
Oh, I think it is, but I think that many of the countries won't be able to pay their dues to the United Nations and will be a tremendous burden on everybody. And there is very often a rather smug approach about these things in countries which are well established. You never know where these things may end, because we're all composed of many different disparate fragments, and this can happen absolutely anywhere. And I don't think it'd be terribly comfortable. I mean, I should hate to go to Edinburgh and have to go through the customs.
When you were researching your book, My Russia, and the associated
television programme in the mid-1980s. Was there any inkling at all of what was to happen? Were you able to make any predictions?
Yes, in fact, I did in the television version, which was roundly attacked by all sorts of critics, saying that I was a fellow traveller, that I was a dupe, that I had the wool pull over my eyes, and all the kind of racket that we're so used to. But, of course, I didn't react. Why should I? How could I? But, curiously enough, now time has passed. Now I'm suddenly treated as an authority on the Soviet Union. I haven't done anything to deserve it, except to predict that this was going to happen, more or less. I couldn't be absolutely sure, because we started the filming during the era of Chernenko. And Gorbachev only took power in the middle of our filming. So it wasn't very clear to see ahead, but what's happened since, I think, is absolutely fabulous, even if they're in a state of disarray, and even if they're imitating all that's worst in the West. I go to great lengths to point out that we need perestroika and glasnost just as much as they do. And I think what happened with Gorbachev is very much like a parent who'd been brought up in a certain way and then gave his sons unexpectedly all the liberty they needed to make their own decisions. And when finally they opened their mouths to talk, they said rather different things from what he hoped. I think that's the experience of any father, really, and it shouldn't surprise anybody. He's a good politician, therefore he's adapted himself to the circumstances. And Yeltsin is a good politician too, and therefore knew when to hang back and give Gorbachev his chance instead of trying to crush him, because Yeltsin knew perfectly well he couldn't carry the whole thing on his own. And I always thought, and I always said, that if the boat starts rocking too much, Yeltsin and Gorbachev will be on the same side, because their interests, their final interests, coincide, however much they seem to quarrel. I even suspect the Russians of quarrelling gratuitously in order to prove to the Americans, above all, that they really understand democracy.
But as you say, they are importing some of the worst features of the West. I was talking to someone last week who'd visited Russia over Soviet Union over 18 years, and on his last trip, he'd just come back, he had his wallet stolen on the way to the airport. Is there any way that they can find a middle way, do you think, without importing the worst features of Western society?
You mean stealing a wallet?
Yeah.
Well, I hope they can, because there are certain moral issues attached to their regime, which has been treated as an evil empire by Reagan and highly suspect. And people blame the theory itself for the collapse of that part of the world. Or others, even more foolish to my eyes, say that it was the threat of nuclear retaliation and all sorts of things which finally brought them to their senses. Mm. It was nothing to do with armaments at all, because they're very hot-headed about those sort of things. No, it wasn't. It was that the walls of the Kremlin became porous through the explosion of information everywhere, and they gradually collapsed, because everybody knew. You couldn't hide what went on in the outside world. On the other hand, their form of socialism, I think there are many worse destinies than to be a child in the Soviet Union. They're very well looked after. They have theatres of their own, restaurants of their own, lending libraries of their own. To be an adolescent is already much more difficult. To be an adult, practically impossible. But it doesn't mean to say that there aren't certain values that they have, even if they're carried out with the most monstrous inefficiency, which are worth salvaging. What happens on a practical level, of course, is still very primitive, and the whole attitude towards physically disabled people or paraplegic is really medieval. They believe that they shouldn't be around, that they shouldn't be seen. They're not allowed onto buses, whereas the whole of the West is full of little ramps and little symbols. And all that is very, very unpleasant. At the same time, there are people of enormous compassion, as Russian literature proves, and there's no reason why they shouldn't catch up in a very short time when they find out everybody else does something different. The main victory, to my mind, is that they've finally caught the train, because they've been running along the platform for centuries, unable to do so, being pushed off by Polish counts and Teutonic knights from the first-class compartments. At last they're on it. They've at last done what Peter the Great, Ivan the Terrible, and all of them tried to do without ever daring to let go the primitive side of this enormous country, and nobody has the same problems as they do.
Well, just to remind ourselves how much things have changed and how much our perception of the Soviet Union has changed, let's have a little comedy excerpt. This from one of your most famous records, the Grand Prix of Gibraltar.
Now, here's an interesting and a rare phenomenon. There is a Russian observer here from the All-Union Center of Sport and... What is it, Mr. Volikov?
All-Union Center of Sports and Machinery.
All-Union Center of Sports and Machinery. Now, Mr. Semyon Volikov, I hope I've got that right.
Yeah, thank you very much.
You're watching this race?
Yes, I have been sent to watch the race.
And I see you've got a camera slung around you. You're going to take photographs of it?
That's the intention.
Is Russia going to produce a racing car soon?
I can't say. I'm not allowed to say.
But that must be the reason why you're here.
I'm afraid I am not in a position to make any declaration at the moment.
But could there be any other reason you're here?
I'm afraid my lips must... necessarily, for the moment, be sealed, but we have some surprises for you, which will be seen in due course.
But I've noticed watching you, Mr. Volikov, that with that camera of yours, you're taking pictures mainly of the rock and not of the racing cars.
I am the observer, not you.
In your book, Usinov at Large, you say that 40,000 children die every day from totally preventable diseases, and you make the comparison in cost between that of 3 fighter aircraft and the vaccine which would be required to prevent those deaths. So what is it about mankind, do you think, that stops us getting together to solve what seem, although massive, quite simple and cheap problems to solve?
Well, it's still this reverence for the archaic idea that defense is tremendously important in the sense of deterrence and so on. Of course, I don't think that deterrence work as deterrence. I don't think they frightened anybody. It certainly didn't frighten Saddam Hussein. And the fact that we let that war, I mean, I thought it was a very dangerous war. It was justified by the fact that the whole United Nations entered by a vote behind it, so that it had the seal of approval. But then once you're going to start a war like that, you must finish it. We finished it like the 1914 war, not like the 1939 war. Like the 1914 war would have stopped the 1939 war on Germany's frontiers, saying Hitler's forming a new government, now it's going to be all right. Yes, I know the Waffen-SS is still persecuting fleeing prisoners, but after all, if the prisoners don't have the luck to reach our borders, it's too bad for them, the Kurdish problem. I mean, that was, to my mind, very, very nerve-wracking. But the idea of war on a big scale, I think that's another feature of the collapse of the Eastern European system, was that Gorbachev realized, perhaps earlier than most, that war, far from being a question of deterrence, if it ever does break out, it's like a casino in which nobody can win. And even the most inveterate gambler is not going to get in there if he can't win. If there isn't a chance, he'll come out with a jackpot. And here there really wasn't, because the capacity for destruction is so disproportionate now that nobody can benefit from it, and therefore Gorbachev suggested, why don't we scrap the whole bloody thing? We'll have much more money at our disposal to deal with the problems that are actually vital. And I must say, before all this started, and when Russia could still ill afford it, it's not my doing, but among others, I mentioned to Gorbachev that I thought their contribution to the children's charities were abnormally low and beneath the dignity of a country of that importance. They were roughly equivalent of Yugoslavia's contribution. And before all this trouble started, their contribution had been multiplied by 12. And it shows that they're already beginning to understand world collaboration outside the frameworks of military alliances. They don't just help North Korea and not the South. And on occasion, they have sent serum and stuff like that to places where it was vitally needed. They've never had any recognition for it, and they don't expect it. but they're already collaborating on a civilized scale in the dramas of the world. But I think if there were a little more money around, if people could forego three fighting.
And then I'm afraid the recording runs out just before the end. I'm not quite sure what happened there. It was towards the end, but the evolution of that recording came from originally from a DAT tape, digital audio tape, a format that didn't last very long. It was on a new recorder the BBC were very pleased about having at Radio Sheffield. I was a bit nervous about using it, more used to a UO reel-to-reel recorder or a cassette recorder. Then it was I transferred it to a cassette for my own archives. And then it was transferred to my iPod, and then from iPod to digital format on my system here, on my editing system here, Adobe Audition. So it's gone through a bit of a genesis, which is why there's some clicking and buzzing at the beginning as well that's picked up along the way. Anyway, that was most of the interview, and I think we get the idea of where Ustinov is coming from. And what's so saddening when you hear that is how much that Russia was expected to be a new and force for good in the world, and look what's happened since with the invasion of Ukraine, the suppression of dissidents and all the rest of it. But it was a time of real hope, was 1991, and Ustinov was one of the good guys in the world, and I was delighted to have met him and to have recorded that interview. I hope you enjoyed it, and I hope it's added to your festivities, if you're having them, or your general enjoyment of whatever you're up to at the moment. Thanks for listening. Back to normal next time with more of my usual subjects. But until then, this is the Richard Rudy Podcast saying take care and good luck to you.